Good morning again. Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, has this term, practice enlightenment. And it's one word for him, practice enlightenment. It's not practice in order to get enlightened. It's practice enlightenment. And it's not practice to get some higher state of consciousness, calmer. It's practice enlightenment. And he does that very consciously, because he wants his goal is to help us come back to just being with whatever activity we're with, completely with that activity, and not in order to. So much of our life is in order to. We're doing this in order to get that. We're doing this in order to make so-and-so feel such and such a way. We're doing so. Of course there's an order to. Of course there's a time sequence. But since we get so trapped by our in order to's, practice enlightenment as one word is what Dogen does over and over and over again. So, if you're really listening to me without being seduced by monkey mind is still maybe chattering, still chattering, but you're really listening, then that's practice enlightenment. So there's nothing more. That's everything. And it can be great joy, great comfort in that, in just this. But if monkey mind takes over, then if you're really doing practice enlightenment, you just come back to giving your attention totally to my words, your breathing, being here. So, and of course, in Buddhism, there are all kinds of things we do in meditation. We follow our breath, we count our breath, we do loving kindness meditation, we do lots of things. But not in order to get something else. We all want to feel better. We all want stress reduction. But if we do it in order to accomplish, stress doesn't really go away. It just builds up. Ever notice that? My zazen. I've already been sitting for 32 minutes and my zazen sucks. And then maybe I shouldn't even be doing this zazen or something. Whatever you say to yourself. So this very simple teaching that these teachers, Dogen, my two teachers, Suzuki and Katagiri, over and over again, if you're making a wholehearted effort to be present with whatever activity you're doing, to live more fully than your chattering self, that's practice enlightenment. So practice enlightenment doesn't mean just passive acceptance of whatever's happening. It means focusing more on experience rather than judgment about the experience. And the example that I have overused, but I'm going to give it again, is with my teacher when he came, my first teacher, Suzuki, when he came to talk at my college, and I was sitting next to him in the front row, and he grabbed my hand and said, "I scared," which surprised me. And then he got up and gave just a wonderful talk. So, as we go deeper into practice enlightenment, we open up. And we can just be sad and then experience that and then move on. Because we're completely sad. We're not, "Oh, I shouldn't be sad," or "I wish I were less sad," or "Oh, I'm angry that I'm sad." Just sad. Or maybe it's, "I'm angry that I'm sad." Then just angry that I'm sad. Just. Shikan means just. Shikan, wherever you can open up, you just open up to this. So as we get deeper into practice enlightenment or enlightenment practice, we begin to see into consciousness, see into how our mind works, and penetrate its layers. And Western psychology does a pretty good job of explaining the small self, talking about the small self. Buddhist psychology does a good job of going beyond the small self and explaining our interconnectedness with everything. But Western psychology is really good at the small self. And we need to, in our lives, have bare awareness of small self so that we can see through it and beyond it. We need to see what monkey mind is up to and how developmentally we use a small self. And in the simplest psychological terms, we have our inner child, who is free, spontaneous, creative, and also completely impulsive in getting its needs met. Completely impulsive. 2 or 3 year old. My grandson, 7 now. When he was 6, he quit having tantrums. Wow. Now he just runs and goes by himself into the bathroom or something when he can't get his immediate need met. But that's the 2 or 3 year old. The 2 or 3 year old needs his needs, needs her needs met. Focuses on what she wants and pushes away what she doesn't want. And tells you directly, directly, with a tantrum or with something else. I don't know why. Well, I do know why. I've had more than one relative who's tantrumed when they were kids. Now, hopefully when we get to be adults, we don't do that anymore because we begin to have the inner child a little bit under control. So my younger grandson, you know, with his tantrums, he'd have the tenacity of a pit bull. Then he'd finally give up and just lose it. One of my kids was like that, too. Not getting what we want and pushing away what we don't want. And then, developmentally, we have the internal parent beginning to come in. As children develop into adults, the inner child becomes contained to a degree by the inner parent. So the story that I told in the class that I just finished teaching about my grandson, my older grandson bringing his Thomas the Train to the U.S. from Paris. Any of you know what Thomas the Train is? Well, some of you know Thomas the Train? Really? Wow. Well, you know, he's got all his special cars, and they have better cars here than in Paris. And you know, so he brought the whole, brings a whole train set here, and then takes the whole train set back to Paris. Well, he did. He's 10. He did that when he was 7, 8. So about 3 or 4 years ago, when he was here with his Thomas the Train set, I had it all set up. We don't have much room, but he had it all set up in the living room. It takes up half the living room, 3/4 of the living room. Well, Logan, who's 2 years younger than him, and I'll say Logan's 3, comes along and all Logan wants to do is suck on the cars. And he starts to have a tantrum if the cars get taken away from him, because that's what he wants, just to suck. So Ethan says to me at some point, "Grandpa, all Logan wants to do is suck on the cars. He can't come in." I said, "This is the living room, Ethan." He can't come in. Stay out, Logan." And then he, under his breath, he says to me, "Mama said I shouldn't be mad because he's just a baby." So he's his parent. He's starting to internalize his parent. "Mama said I shouldn't be mad because he's just a baby." And by 10, he's internalized his parent pretty well. So he's got his internal parent, which is keeping his impulsive behaviors in line, pretty much. So that's what happens in Western. That's what happens in all of us, but that's how we explain it in Western developmental psychology. That then we develop. That's how we develop. The only problem is, and I don't understand why this happens. There must be some evolutionary reason for this happening. The internal parent seems to, in 98% of the time, turn into a stern, forbidding, mean inner critic. What's the deal there? But that seems to happen. And I know that very well, just from my own life and from having had one-to-ones with people for 25, 30 years. And the ego's job is to mediate. Between the needs of the inner child and the you should not do this, you should do this, of the inner parent. Because the inner parent comes down so strong, it turns into such a mean being, which is beyond me why that happens, but it does seem to happen. And probably we wouldn't even have all you guys here at the Zen Center meditating if it didn't happen, so maybe it's cool that it happens. I don't know. Maybe so. I don't think I would have started meditating. So our goal in Western psychology is to develop a strong but non-rigid ego, an ego that can mediate. An ego that can keep the inner critic in check. No, I'm not listening to you when the critic tells me something or other. I don't know. What am I telling me? No, I'm not listening to you. And we can talk to the inner critic in the same way we might talk to someone we love. Thank you for protecting me from embarrassing experiences. I understand that was helpful, but right now I would really like to take a risk and be brave and learn how to, let's say, write on Roxu. I was talking about that last time, writing on the inside of one of these as a teacher. First time I had to do it 15 years ago, I think I talked about this a couple weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, I was scared because of my experience in the first grade, that I could never learn to write with my left hand, that people could never do that. They would always be, my teacher said that I'd always be crippled. That's what she said in the first grade, if I wrote with my left hand. So that my inner critic, I'm not listening to you, inner critic. I'm going to write on the Roxu. And then I did. And then I did. And then I did. And then I did. And now I still am. And I don't have to say too much to the inner critic anymore. But sometimes the inner critic still comes up. So ego is important to help us mediate the power of the critic so we can crack open beyond the confines of even ego to the vastness and wonder of enlightened practice, practice enlightenment. The whole universe flooding through us, all life flooding through us. And as we begin to crack open, we discover that there's not one, just one self. Well, you could say that there are three using Western psychological terms, but actually a multiplicity of selves that live inside us. Some are primary, and they make up our personality. Some are in the shadow. Some are secondary. The ones that are in the shadow, we disown because we don't like those. My father was rational, analytical, and powerful, but never vulnerable or emotional. He disowned that part of himself. We all have that part of ourselves. We all have a vulnerable, emotional part. But he disowned it. actually, in fairness to him, men of his generation in the U.S. did disown that generally. There were some exceptions, but most of them did. So it impacted his behavior. It impacts our behavior. The shadow side always impacts our behavior. And, you know, he didn't do that. None of the guys he hung out with did that. Or vulnerable, or showed any vulnerability or emotionality. Now, maybe some did. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but my dad sure didn't. He'd be a wuss if he did that, right? So instead, he married an emotional and vulnerable woman, right? Because our shadow side always comes up somewhere. Our disowned side always comes up. And sometimes my dad adored my mother for her easy... how in touch she was with her emotions. But sometimes she made him crazy because he felt that she was emotionally out of control. So a disowned self is an energy pattern that has partially or fully been excluded. It can also hold our unhealed wounds. Every time it emerges, it's punished or disapproved of by someone outside or inner critic. So we press it back down. And to know our disowned selves, all we need to do is think of someone who you intensely dislike or overly admire. Probably. Probably there. The intensity of the feeling means something. And of course, in spirituality, we're taught not to judge. Too often we disown our discriminating ability. I can remember being a young Zen student. I disowned my discriminating ability, which is a valuable teacher. We need to discriminate. but we do that. The discriminating ability kind of can show us what's disowned and what we need to heal. So the Western psychologist Hal Stone says, for what we repress in ourselves, we attract people who are exactly like our disowned selves. They will extremely trigger us, and or we will adore them too much. So long as a self is disowned in us, we will repeatedly attract the kind of person who holds that pattern. And then in Buddhist psychology, we have a different way of talking about a multiplicity of selves, the six selves that operate in each of the six realms. The depressed or anxious self in the hell realm, the greedy animalistic self that wants food and immediate comfort in the animal realm, the needy, emotionally bereft self in the hungry ghost realm, the human self where we're trying to balance inner child and inner parent and just do our practice, fighting part of ourselves in the fighting spirit realm, part that wants to get ahead, wants to prevail, and then the God part of ourselves, where we've got it made. So that's the West. That's the Eastern way. That's a Buddhist way of talking about multiplicity of selves. So in class, I used the example of Donald Trump, and I think it's time to quit using examples about Donald Trump. I think we've overdone him. But can't say he didn't bring it on himself, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, the example of Donald Trump. Well, what's Donald Trump's main self? Fighting spirit, big time. And then Donald Trump sometimes moves into a God realm. He's always trying to get into the God realm, talking about the Trump this, the Trump that. You can see how he's aspiring to the God realm. And then he gets into it sometimes. We're all the greatest. Everything's the greatest. Then someone criticizes him, and what happens? Just a little bit of criticism. What happens when someone criticizes him? Hmm?
He explodes into
Pardon?
He explodes.
Yes. And he goes into a hell realm.
Yes.
Immediately. So that's Buddhist psychology for you. From a God realm, you go into a hell realm. So Donald Trump is teaching us. Teaching us. How the showing us the pattern that we all go through. Patterns that we all go through. So here's what Walt Whitman and Rumi have to say about this multiplicity of selves. Walt Whitman, do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. So we contain multitudes. Isn't that wonderful? We contain multitudes. If we just open up to them, we can really appreciate them. Really appreciate them. And then the Rumi quote, be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Half of any person is wrong and weak and off the path. The other half is dancing and swimming and flying in the invisible sky. So to dissolve our identification with this glommed together self, we practice. We practice the paramitas. Generosity, we try to be generous to ourselves and others. We try to be patient with ourselves and others. We try to do virtuous behavior, which means behavior where we're true to something we really care about. Our core values of feeling connected to each other and connected to ourselves. We make effort, we practice meditation, and the outcome is wisdom. But the outcome is practice enlightenment, not practice in order to get enlightenment. Referred to in Buddhist thought as bodhicitta. So, but I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm going to talk about that right now. Instead, I'm going to move on to talk about communication. Communication. So, communication is important for us as Buddhist practitioners, as beings in the world. How much of our time do we spend communicating? A whole bunch of our time. Most of our lives we're communicating in one way or another. And how you're listening now, how you're holding your body as you listen, is a way in which you're communicating. You're saying something to yourself and to others. That's a form of communication. And is it possible that when we're sad, we can just practice enlightenment, sad, be sad, completely feel it, and then move on? When we're scared, practice enlightenment, scared, really feel it, and then move on? And if it follows up, that's okay. We don't have to say, bad, bad, you shouldn't still be with me. Just let it be. Just let it be. So practice enlightenment communication begins with our awareness of suffering. Recognizing the pain of the world and of ourselves and of our friends and hearing that, listening to that, opening to it. We can say compassionate communication. That's what people say, but compassion is extra. It's a three-syllable word. It's really big. It's just listening and being present. Just listening and being present to the suffering in the world, including our own suffering. Our own pain, our own weariness, our own I sad, I scared. See, I'm not even using the am because I still have the tape in me from my teacher's Japanese. We get these tapes in them. Sometimes they're helpful and sometimes they're not so helpful, right? So we never know quite what to do. We never know how to fix things. But we engage, we express. Practice enlightenment, enlightenment practice, enlightened practice, period. And when our communication is wholehearted, we authentically are able to experience and express what we're feeling right now. And even if we're only feeling this, we experience this. We express this. Not being paralyzed by any one feeling or any one little glommed together self. We all feel fear when we put ourselves out there. It's a human situation. When you put yourself out there through your words, through your song, through your art, you're going to feel scared. But if you do it, the fear doesn't stay because you give yourself to the activity. You give yourself to the writing. You give yourself to the thinking. You give yourself to the driving. You give yourself to the creating. So that's pretty wonderful, isn't it, that we can do that? Isn't it pretty wonderful that we can sit here together, that we can just feel happy sometimes, just sad sometimes, just see that without commenting on it, and move fully into our life without being paralyzed? What, we can completely be here like this, and then the next moment it will be like that? We don't know what it's going to be like. It's going to be like that, whatever that is. And we don't know, and that's a little scary. But can we just open to that? And then it's kind of wonderful. It's kind of wonderful. And we don't have to be gloomy and depressed. But as I was saying in the class I was teaching, if that's what we are, if we're depressed, just express that. Just be Eeyore. Just be Eeyore. Now I'm going to read from about Eeyore. Good morning, Pooh Bear, said Eeyore gloomily. If it is a good morning, which I doubt. Why? What's the matter? Nothing, Pooh Bear. Nothing. We can't, all of us, and some of us don't. That's all there is to it. Can't all what? Said Pooh, rubbing his nose. Gaiety, song and dance. Here we go round the mulberry bush, said Eeyore. But we can transparently express enlightenment practice right now. And if it's an Eeyore enlightenment practice to Pooh, we can be generous to Pooh with our Eeyore-like feeling. And if you go back and read Winnie the Pooh, you'll see how generous Eeyore was. Right in his feeling to Pooh. How generous he was, and how open he was, and how giving he was. And how patient he was with Pooh. You go back and read it. How patient he was, just in his very patient in that. Very patient. Because he loved Pooh. He loved Pooh. By loving ourselves just as we are, we love others. We love others. And I'm going through all the paramitas now. He did virtuous behavior with Pooh. He was authentic. He didn't try to hide his depression. And he didn't run and hide. He went out and did stuff with Pooh, even though he did it, you know, in his Eeyore-like way. That's okay. That's what is. That's what is. So the paramitas that I've been talking about are guidelines to how we express our practice enlightenment in everyday activity, in the way we meet with each other, our family members, and the way we listen, and the way we express our own truth to each other, our own truth. Our practice, our awareness, and expression, that's all interconnected stuff, isn't it? It's all interconnected. That's why Dogen says we are enlightened by our delusion. We're enlightened by our delusion. We can be present in our fear. We can be willing just to sit upright as the person you are in this situation, in a world that's dangerous. It's dangerous. It's always been dangerous, but we can just be here with it. Just be there with it. And give ourselves, but not leaving ourselves out, not saying, inner critic saying, I should give myself more. If the inner critic says that, then just... help the little inner critic settle down. Give the inner critic a smooch. The inner critic will be alarmed if you give her a smooch. That's good. That's good. So we can move beyond any opinion that we're stuck on and just be. And I want to finish off by reading a quote from Dogen and talking a little bit about it. You can understand all of Buddhism, but you cannot go beyond your abilities and your intelligence unless you have grandmother heart mind. Grandmother heart mind. So parents attend to the nuts and bolts of their kids, feeding them, sheltering them, keeping them warm, protecting them from cars, from sugar. My daughter's always trying to protect my grandkids from sugar. As we did. We tried to protect our kids so much from sugar. We were living on the north shore of Lake Superior in a kind of semi-communal situation, that when we once took my son, who was maybe four, well, my daughter was there too, maybe four, into town, into Two Harbors, went into the big city of Two Harbors, and bought them stuff at the cafe in Two Harbors to eat. My son saw someone with a hot fudge sundae, and he said, "Oh, Mom, yogurt and molasses." Yes, I guess we did a pretty good job of protecting our kids from sugar. Until, you only do that for so long, right? But that's the parents. That's what parents have to do. That's what we do. Grandparents, wow. We get to, parents are in the foreground. We get to be in the background. We get to be here with our grandkids and in the big sky and the lake and playing soccer and in nature, going to Disneyland. I'm only interested in going to Disneyland when I'm with my grandkids. Oh, I love Disneyland. Other than that, I hate Disneyland. Like, grandmother heart mind, right? Practice enlightenment, grandmother heart mind. The background, the water, the air, the stars. Our grandma always has our backs. She always has our backs. She's here and she has our backs. Grandmother heart mind. Well, let's say grandfather heart mind too. But Dogen said grandmother. I want to get in there too. So more than 15 years ago, I went to India to meet my daughter-in-law-to-be's family, since her family's from India. And Linda and I decided to also go to southern India. We went to a lot of different little temples in southern India, little Hindu temples. We didn't go to Buddhist India. Buddhist India is what's left of it is in the foothills of the Himalayas, but we didn't go there. Anyway, in the Hindu temples, little Hindu temples in the out of middle of nowhere, people I heard people in the temples chanting when I went in, and several different temples I heard people chanting. Ma, ma, ma. And I didn't know anything about it at the time, but it just touched my heart. The ma, ma, ma. And then later, I read about it, and I saw that they were there worshiping Kali. That the ma, ma is calling Kali, who is the mother, grandmother, the dark one, who includes all life. And by calling to the dark one, the dark mother, grandmother that includes all of us and supports all of us, then she's there. So in the calling her is the response. The call is the response. The practice is the enlightenment. And I think that's why I was touched by hearing them, because it was so full and so sincere. So then when I came back home to Minneapolis, I started when Shattering Mind would come in or Inner Critic would come in, just going, ah, to myself. And actually, I've been doing that now for 15 years. That's my own mantra, my own sacred mantra, passed down generation from generation, or something like that. Something like that. And I had, I don't know how many of you did, but I had one grandmother who's still in my heart, who was like that. Another grandmother was not so much like that. Not so much like that. She was too busy being good. Be careful of people who are too busy being good. Be careful of yourself. If you get too busy being good, you forget. You forget how to just be. How to just be. Anyway, I think that's all I want to say for today. I think that's all I want to say. Now, that grandmother is always here. always supporting us. She doesn't judge us. I guess that's not all I wanted to say.
Yeah.
She doesn't judge us. She doesn't. You can screw up as many times as you want. You can be mean to yourself or others. She's just there for you. And she's not a she. She's your practice enlightenment. But if you want to make her up there, that's cool. Or down there, that's cool. And we're lucky that she's here. We're lucky she's here. But we forget about her. That's why we do practice enlightenment. Okay. I think I'll see if there are any questions or comments. Yeah, both of you. Both of you.
I just had a story. I'm the middle child, and I'm the stubborn one in our family, and I can remember as a child getting in a huge argument with my younger brother, and I remember the analogy he used. He said, "You're as stubborn as four mules on a bad day."
I see. And how was that for you?
I remember the analogy because I was like, it's fitting in some aspects, but as an adult, I think it's becoming less.
So when that comes up for you still, is it helpful to see that? And can
it
you
is,
see it and
it
and then just open to it without going, ugh?
Because the question I then had to kind of follow up was that I think our idiosyncrasies can come out differently as we become adults.
Yes, yes, So we have to we have the opportunity to pay very close attention, don't we?
Right.
And just notice what's going on. Notice what the need there is. Notice what what that little child is wanting, with compassion, with grandmotherly compassion, with grandfatherly compassion. I want to include myself. Thanks. Deb.
So my question is kind of the grandmother's being too good, and kind of the white knight who is the fighter who wants to fix things and make things right.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Various situations. Where does that fall in the six realms? Isn't that really a fighting?
Oh,
the
one who's trying to be too good
or fix,
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know where it fits into the six realms. It's certainly not. It's an aspiration that's kind of gone awry. Okay. So, Yeah.
Fighting aspect.
Yeah,
to
so
it,
I think it's somehow it's moving from the human realm into the fighting spirit realm, but not being aware that it's a fighting spirit. Human, as a human, we have an aspiration. I have an aspiration to support you. That's the human realm. Human realm, we want. The human realm is good because there's an equal amount of pleasure and pain. In the lower realms, it's mostly painful. In the upper realms, it's mostly pleasure. We get seduced by that. The human realm, okay, so I have an aspiration to help you, but then I get into fighting spirit about needing to help you. And you don't want to be helped by me because I'm too focused on trying to be good or you're trying to be good. So maybe it comes in there. I don't know. Uh-huh. But it does come into our lives a lot. And especially, I just want to say one more thing, especially in religion. Be careful of religion. This is a religion that we're doing here. Be careful. Religion which is focused on trying to be good creates all kinds of problems, you guys. Because we think we're being, this is the way to be good. And then we close down and aren't aware of things. We're just focusing on being good. But our grandmother heart mind includes all the disowned parts of ourselves. We need to pay attention to those. Yeah.
I guess I'm not following you when you say things like too good or be aware of being like exclusively good or religions that preach, for instance, you always want to be good.
Yes, well, if I get some idea about being good, let's see, for a Zen teacher, being good for me, I would be good if I never spaced out when my students are talking to me. That would be good. That would be good.
Well, is that kind of neutral? Is that
something? It's an aspiration. I have that aspiration. My aspiration I've never had a one-to-one with you. But my aspiration when I'm having one-to-one with you is just to listen the way I was talking about and not to space off. But let's say that I'm having some pain, or let's say I'm having some psychological pain, and I do start to space off. And then my inner critic says, get back there. You're not doing a good enough job. You've got to do this better. And that kind of good can be paralyzing.
But that's not really good.
Oh, no, it's not really good. Really good is grandmother heart mind.
Well,
that's really good.
You're not being, bad by spacing out.
Well, I used to be a therapist. If you space out as a therapist, you're being bad. I paid you $80 for you to listen to me, and you're just thinking about your grandkids the whole time. That's bad.
No, I disagree with you there.
Honestly. You disagree with me? Oh, well.
No, but I don't. It's human.
It's human.
Space out.
Well, then that's grandmother heart mind.
Mm. And I think it's when we don't forgive and we set the standards so high we can't possibly meet them, and then we set them for other people. And I think that's in the judgment. I think that's the problem.
The problem is being judgmental. That's the problem. Being judgmental. And if you can be good without being judgmental, that's cool. That's grandmother heart mind. But it's very hard for people who are religious and people who are not religious to be good without the inner critic coming down on them. You should have done this. You should do this. You didn't do this. He didn't do this. He should have. It's very hard. It may not be hard for you, but for most people it is.
Yeah, you're right. I don't understand.
Well, hey, then that's cool.
Okay, I think really, things happen, and that's human.
Uh-huh.
That's part of the human experience.
That's right. Well, you're a Zen teacher without even practicing.
I train.
Pardon?
I trained.
You trained, okay. 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 Yeah.
You mentioned Rumi, and I love Rumi too, and that Ma story that you told is reminding me of something from a Rumi poem, very similar.
Okay.
A man was praying to Allah, just calling to Allah, and someone else came along and criticized him. So you're always calling to Allah. Have you ever responded? And Rumi said, it's in that call that you get the response.
Uh-huh.
That longing.
Uh-huh.
And that reminded me of what you were saying about calling out.
Uh-huh. Yes, yes, thank you, thank you, thank you, very beautiful. And someone in the back there?
You mentioned the role of a strong...
Can you speak a little louder?
You mentioned the role of a strong and flexible ego in mediating the balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was wondering what a person could do if they wanted to develop a stronger and more flexible ego, like if you pay attention to that consciously, is that something that you can develop, or do you just have to...
Well, he said, well, what if someone wants to seize this issue of the struggle between the inner child and the inner parent and themselves, and they want to bring more balance and more ego balance? What do they do? How do they do that? How do they work on that? Well, the simplest answer, but it's not doesn't necessarily always work, is to be in psychodynamic therapy. Now, not cognitive behavioral therapy, psychodynamic therapy. And I don't have time enough to talk about the difference, but maybe I do. No, I don't think I do. But psychodynamic therapy. Does that make sense to you? Uh-huh. Is it? Yeah. Pamela.
You talked about communication, and if we know ourselves, then we'll know others. And you talked about compassion being extra. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, it's just that the word compassion, I was just been joking here, and I joked in the class about it being a three-syllable word. It's a feeling. When we feel connected, there's compassion. We can't help but being compassionate when we feel connected. When our heart mind is open, we realize that it's everybody else's heart mind, and we are going to be compassionate. But then if we think too much about it, we start getting all jumbled up about, am I compassionate enough? Is this real compassion? So we can forget compassion and just do what Dogen says, to study the Buddhism, to study the way, is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be intimate with all life, to be actualized by all life. That's compassion. That's a test of whether intimacy, that's a test of interconnectedness, is compassion. But it doesn't think like, I'm compassionate. That's extra. That's some special religion. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense, Pamela? Sure. Sure. Lawrence.
I have a question anyway. I've been going, I'm going to Wednesday to the improvised dance group.
Yes. Lawrence has been going on Wednesday to an improvised dance group. I'm telling them in there. And Lawrence is quite a dancer, aren't you, Lawrence?
Well, I don't know about that. The question is, and what happens is you allow yourself to listen to the music and not conceptualize about it and to go with it.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I find myself being very connected with it and able to go along with it.
Uh-huh.
Other times I find myself more disconnected, and those times I kind of wait for music and just allow the disconnection to happen. I kind of wait for music to kind of carry me along,
Yes.
And then eventually get into it. But last week I went and I didn't like the music and I wasn't feeling very connected. And then I noticed everybody else was feeling connected, and I didn't really feel like I was connecting. And I started to feel bad about that, kind of that I wasn't connecting. And then I never did get into it. So how would you advise me to getting beyond those points?
How would I advise you to deal with that?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I would just then allow yourself to fully experience the fact that you don't want to be there, that music doesn't attune with you right now. Just fully be with that. That's fine, you know.
Well, I tried.
That's fine.
I didn't feel good.
Well, I can't say anything except just be more with it then. Be more open, bigger to it. Just allow yourself to be Eeyore or any derivation of Eeyore at any moment. Just allow yourself to be that. That's what's coming up already. If you can allow yourself to be that, there's compassion that comes out of that, because there's a feeling of intimacy with this, what's going on.
There's been other times where I hear music and I didn't particularly care for music at all. I was so into it, it didn't matter. You know, I just keep going.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't stop from dancing.
Yeah, well, we all want those times. You know?
Right.
But that's not always what we get.
Right.
And when we have those times, we don't have to call on grandmother heart mind. But it's the times when we feel bad that we have an opportunity to remember to call on Ma.
So how would you suggest getting beyond it?
I wouldn't suggest trying to get beyond it at all.
Okay.
No. I'm not suggesting trying to get beyond it. I'm suggesting opening.
Okay. Just be with those
times. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's practice enlightenment. Not practice in order to.
Okay.
Practice enlightenment. Let's see. I think there were two more, and then we have to do the... Oh, okay, one more.
Well, when you talk about forgetting the self...
Yeah?
And also about dealing with the ego.
Uh-huh. Pardon?
There is a contradiction in it.
The relationship in the ego?
When we, as following Buddha, we forget about the self.
Yeah, yeah.
We understand what is not to have a self.
Yeah.
Because the self tells how we identify with form.
Yeah.
And that means ego.
Yeah.
So in working with trying to deal with the ego and balance the ego with,
yeah,
it's a contradiction.
So is it what?
Contradiction.
Oh, well... yeah, I know it seems like a contradiction, but taking care of ego is also practice enlightenment. Taking care of ego is practice enlightenment. Practice enlightenment has to include taking care of ego. And by taking care of ego, we're not caught by ego so much.
Mm-hmm.
By taking care of ego, we forget ego. But we have to take care of it.
I was making a comment because I guess sometimes the words we say...
Yes.
The way we...
It does seem like a contradiction, so I'm glad. It does seem like, but it's not. I'm glad you brought that up. It's not. See, we think forgetting the self means denying the self. Then we get into some religious trip again about being good, but it doesn't mean denying the self. It's studying the self in our bare awareness, in our meditation.
I guess I was trying to say the easiest form, easiest way to understand how to disassociate from the self that we consider ourselves. Oh, my job, that's myself. Oh, my looks, that's myself. Or
yes,
whatever it is, that kind of self that is any external.
Yes, our meditation is a way in which we begin to disidentify. We begin to see the different forms that come up, the different patterns that come up. We concentrate on our meditation so we can calm down and see those, and then we begin to disidentify spontaneously by just seeing that they're just pictures, that it's just a radio program, that it's just a pattern. And the identification takes place on its own, and it takes place in its own time, and it can't be forced. But that's what meditation is.
Yeah, and may I say one more little thing?
Sure, sure.
The gentleman over
there? Sure.
He struggles listening to music and taste again.
Yes.
So, about that surrendering, doesn't come from, okay, I'm going to just take it as it is, and I'm here, so I'm going to have to just put up with it. It's not an external surrendering, some of the internal. So when you say it is what it is, you are there, and then you can do three things. You can say, okay, I'm going to just be here, no complaining, no excuses, just I'm going to just accept it, but from within. Or you can just leave. That's it. You leave it behind. You stand up. Or you do something about it. So there are three ways out of being a situation that is so maybe uncomfortable. So we have good choices. And then when you decide to be there, it just really truly does surrender. No excuses. It's there.
Very good. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you all.